From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. The UN today is trying to secure a 48-hour pause in fighting in Aleppo, Syria, so that aid can be delivered.
Will a little boy's picture help? Now, fighting in Aleppo has intensified as rebel groups have made significant gains but drawn retaliatory bombings from Russia and other Syrian allies. Last week, Russia set a 3-hour temporary suspension to allow food and medical supplies through, but the UN said that wasn't enough. And then this week, the dispute took on a tiny, dust-covered, bloody human face. You've probably seen the little boy pulled from the rubble after an airstrike, sitting by himself in an ambulance, silent. Never has a soul seemed more alone, not knowing, of course, that millions will see him on social media. The 5-year-old has been identified as Amram Dakhnish. He's been released from care. Nazanin Ash is Policy and Advocacy Director at the International Rescue Committee. Nazanin, what did you at the IRC think when you saw that picture?
For us, seeing that image was a reminder of images we see all the time. We've got 2,000 humanitarian aid workers on the ground in Syria, Syrians helping fellow citizens. Those images are all too common for them.
Yeah. Well, people are hoping it might be a wake-up call. And there's another tweet going out now. It's a split-screen cartoon. It shows little Amran in the ambulance on one side, and then that 3-year-old drowned refugee child who washed up on the beach of a resort in Greece on the other side of the screen. And the captions read, "Options for children in Syria, stay or go." You know, the implication, either way, it doesn't matter. Talk about this 5-year civil war impact on children.
It's been tremendous. The devastation has rendered decades of international law on the protection of civilians in conflict irrelevant. As you know, in the 5 years of this war, there have been 400,000 civilian deaths. There are 13.5 million people in desperate need of assistance in Syria. That's more than half the population. There are 6 million children in need, 2 million people in need in Aleppo alone. Amran is the face of so many.
Yeah. Well, and Syria's losing a whole generation, we're hearing. I mean, 8.4 million children actually affected in some way. That's more than 80% of the country's young population.
That's right. In 5 years, we've seen this war wipe out decades of development in Syria. You're talking about a stable, middle-income country where now over 75% of the population lives in extreme poverty, where nearly 4 million Syrian children in and outside of Syria are out of school. We are looking at multiple lost generations as a result of this vicious, violent, long-standing civil war. And to your point, you know, the images that we're seeing around the world today of Amran inside Syria contrasted with Aylan Kurdi washed up on the beaches in Turkey, that represents the choices that Syrian families face. You know, put your children in incredible harm if you stay, at the risk of aerial strikes, at the risk of starvation, or take your best chances and leave and, you know, face a perilous journey and an uncertain outcome on the shores where you land.
Look, American military officials say they don't see any ISIS presence in and around Aleppo, which is why, you know, they don't strike there and why they don't think the Russians should be. You know, it's long been said that the Russians are actually targeting these anti-Assad rebel groups that are in and around the city. We'll put the politics and the strategy aside. If aid workers are trying to get this halt, and it's hoped that the picture of Amran will help with that cessation of violence for even a short period of time, to go in and bring supplies, why can't they bring children out?
Because the circumstances are so treacherous. In so many ways, the 3-hour ceasefires and the talk of humanitarian corridors and the talk of humanitarian access has been a farce with respect to the realities on the ground. What UN convoys have been able to deliver is food aid to less than 4% of those who need it and medical supplies to less than 1%.
Nazanin Ash, Policy and Advocacy Director at the International Refugee Committee in Washington. Do you think this picture will change anything? The picture of Amran, the picture of the little boy, you know, washed up on a beach, really didn't.
Well, you know, what we saw was an outpouring of support in the form of donations and just citizens all over the world looking for ways that they can help. But that is a temporary response. It hasn't had an impact on what's been, you know, the most prominent impasse in this conflict, which is whether the multiple parties, Western powers, the Iranians, the Turks, the Russians, and most importantly, the Assad regime, can align their interests, recognize the devastating consequences, and bring an end to this conflict. That's really what this picture needs to motivate.
Nazanin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Gold medal swimmer Ryan Lochte says he's sorry for his behavior last weekend when he claimed he was robbed at gunpoint in Rio. He apologized on Instagram after Brazilian police said Lochte lied about his story. Well, here's another athlete who has nothing to apologize for.
Here's Bolt. He makes it look easy. Bolt, 200 triple.
On NBC last night, Usain Bolt winning the 200 for the third straight Olympics. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman was there, and he joins us from Rio. And Tom, to watch this man run, it almost defies description. What can you say about what Usain Bolt has done?
I'll pick up on what he said, Peter, last night, which was, what more can I do? So as people who watch him, what more can we say? Although I will try. He's one of those people who comes along and redefines what we think about something, in this case, running really fast. He said last night that he showed the world it could be done clean. It appears that he has done that. And so we celebrate his greatness. As Ashton Eaton said last night, it's been an honor to compete in Bolt's era, and it's been an honor for us to watch for those 40-some-odd seconds every 4 years. That's really what it is. It's the 100, the 200, and his leg of the 4x100 adds up to about 40 seconds of finals action. It's amazing that in that little bit of time we have come to see such thrilling greatness.
Well, you mentioned the name Ashton Eaton. Now, he could claim the title again as the world's greatest athlete because he won the Olympic decathlon for the second straight Olympic Games last night. I was watching video of him. He also just seems like a generally nice guy. But he deserves to be right up there with Bolt, doesn't he, when it comes to Olympic history?
Well, certainly for accomplishment. I think it's different. You know, the sprints that Bolt does are so explosive. And as we said, 40 seconds, you know, and the whole world tunes in for that time. With the decathlon, it's 10 events spread over 2 days. And, you know, sometimes your attention can wane, like in the javelin or the shot put or whatever. But the end result is, yeah, it's astounding. He's only the third man to win two decathlons, another phenomenal performance. And that's what Rio is turning into. I mean, you look at Sports Illustrated, you know, the Sports Illustrated cover jinx, well known to sports fans. Well, Ashton Eaton and Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky and Simone Biles were all on that cover. They all delivered with breathtaking performances. And of course, Usain Bolt, we'd throw that, him in there too.
Yeah, well, Tom, we're almost done with these Olympics. The closing ceremony is Sunday night. What are you looking forward to in the next couple of days as the games wrap up?
Coming home.
Besides that, the sports, Tom.
Well, you know, I think for the host country, we have, I don't know what adjectives to use when I talk about Brazil versus Germany in men's soccer. Of course, everyone remembers 7-1. If you don't, you're not a soccer fan. Certainly, they remember the 7-1 shellacking in the 2014 World Cup at the hands of Germany. So here it is set up again with a Neymar-led Olympic team going against the Germans. And then you have a few other events wrapping up. The men's marathon, I think, will be interesting. And then the men's basketball. I don't know if that's interesting, really, but we'll see if the U.S. can continue its dominance. Certainly the women should, and the men should as well.
All right. And when you do get home and you've had a moment to sleep and to breathe and to gather your thoughts, what are you going to remember about Rio down the road?
I'm going to remember the performances that I mentioned, the superstar performances, and all of them delivered. I don't think there's ever been an Olympics like that. You know, all of them, from Biles to Phelps to Bolt to Eaton. And then, of course, you know, what I will think about with great regret are all the events that I wasn't able to get to. The Summer Olympics is overwhelming. And to think that you can cover all of it, that's a fool's errand. You just can't. And so I'll think of all those great, badminton players. You know, there may be Bolts out there in badminton and in table tennis and in taekwondo and in sailing that we just didn't get to, and we don't know very well, and I'll regret that. And I think in general, I'll think a pretty amazing Olympics, considering what we were saying before we went in. There have been problems. Certainly Ryan Lochte was responsible for some of those the last week. But as far as Zika, as far as people getting sick from the water, as far as terrorist attacks, we haven't seen that so far. My only concern is Brazil will be so exhausted by getting this thing done and getting it done without a major hiccup, they might not put on a good show for the Paralympics. And I hope that's not the case.
Yeah, yeah. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman in Rio, who, by the way, probably has the best assignment in public radio for the past 2 weeks. Tom, thank you. You're almost done.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
The rainstorm that inundated Louisiana this week was a 1-in-500-year weather event, which doesn't mean it can only happen every 500 years. It means it's rare. But there have been around 8 around the country this year alone. The drought in California has been super fuel for fires. And this week, NASA announced July was the warmest single month on record since they started keeping track in 1880. So is this year a climate change tipping point? Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist for Slate and co-host of the podcast Warm Regards. Eric, start with this storm in Louisiana. How unusual was it?
Sure. So weather balloons twice a day at every National Weather Service office in the country measure the content of water vapor in the clouds in the atmosphere above where they were launched. And at this moment, I think it was Thursday morning or Friday morning last week, the atmosphere above southern Louisiana was among the wettest that has ever been measured there.
Explain that, because you think, well, it's either raining, wet's 100% wet, mm-hmm. or it's not. I mean, what do you mean by that?
So as the planet gets warmer because of greenhouse gases, warmer air can hold more water vapor. This is a basic tenet of atmospheric physics. And you can kind of test this, you know, on a warm day when you're in air conditioning, you see condensation on the windows if you're inside and it's really humid outside. Mm-hmm. So that's water vapor that's just being squeezed out of the atmosphere, and that's exactly what happened in Louisiana. Is that the Gulf of Mexico right now is record warm. We have 90 degree water temperatures down there. And this storm system sort of acted like a funnel for that warm, wet air to be pushed and concentrated right over southern Louisiana for days.
Yeah. But was this something that scientists, researchers, meteorologists predicted? You know, this idea that as the water and the air warms, we're going to have more extreme rain.
Exactly. No, we've been predicting this for decades. And when I say we, I mean the entire scientific community. It's not a controversial result, really, that as the planet warms, that we'll start to see more extremes in precipitation on both ends. Mm-hmm. You know, evaporation also increases with temperature, the rate of evaporation. So we're getting drier dries and wetter wets. And we're seeing that, you know, at the same time on the other side of the country, we're seeing this sort of really rapidly advancing forest fires in California.
Because of how the drier dry out there. Mm-hmm. And then hotter hot. Talk about the notion that July, hottest month on record. But for sometimes the average observer, it can feel like, well, you said last month was hot too. You know, where would you put this new news? How big is this new news about July?
Yeah, and at some point it gets a little bit monotonous when July was the 15th consecutive record-setting month on a global basis. So part of this is a result of the El Niño that's just passed. We still don't totally understand how this happens, but it seems that El Niño can sort of motivate warm water that's being stored in the surface layers of the ocean, and that just sort of pours out into the atmosphere during El Nino years.
And that, as we know it, is a natural occurrence.
Yeah, that's a natural occurrence, but it's also an active area research of how this El Nino process might change with increasing global temperatures. But, you know, the bottom line is that we have a different atmosphere now. I think that's the best way to think about it, is that we have a different base conditions. We have a different playing field for weather events to happen in. And it's not so much that, oh, is this flood or is this fire linked to climate change or is it caused by climate change? I think that's the wrong question at this point. I think we have a different fundamental expectation for what we can expect now.
I found myself thinking the other day, oh gosh, you know, I happen to love the heat, but I mean, people were actually struggling to breathe here on the East Coast and when temperatures were over 100 and the humidity was, you know, almost 100 as well. And I started thinking, well, what happens if in 50 years, you know, I mean, are you already eyeing super dangerous temperatures?
Well, I'm here speaking from Tucson, Arizona, too. So yeah, I mean, we had among the warmest days on record here in Arizona earlier this year. But that's when it starts raising, you know, big red flags in your mind, saying that there are fundamental thresholds to the temperatures that humans can withstand. And there's been some research to say that we're talking about the water content over Louisiana last week. Once that water content hits a point to where your body can no longer sweat to cool down, then you've reached the point of, you know, the upper threshold of humans being able to exist outside. And this is sort of sounds like science fiction stuff, but it's actually in predictions baked in for potentially our lifetimes, you know, towards the end of the century. You know, hopefully we'll live that long, but our children probably definitely will. It's something that it's really hard to convey in our daily news cycle when we have, you know, so much else to go on, that we have something huge that's happening right now and we're locking in further change.
Yeah. Well, in December, almost every country in the world met in Paris and agreed to limit average global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and they'd have to do that by different means. That's considered the threshold for dangerous climate change impacts. Are we there? Are close enough?
Well, we are there. You know, if you factor in the warming that's still in the pipeline, and, you know, as I was saying, the upper layers of the ocean can store heat for decades, and it takes a while for that to get squeezed out into the atmosphere. And so we have committed to a temperature rise of roughly 1.5 degrees. We're right at that point right now. So what does it mean that we're you know, essentially past that tipping point? That's what the scientists are trying to figure out right now. So there's still time to prevent a worst case scenario. And I think Paris probably did that. You know, those ultra high business as usual scenarios are probably off the table at this point because of Paris.
Yeah.
But we're still locked into something well above that 1.5 or even possibly above the 2-degree threshold that's been discussed for decades now.
Rito Rudy, who's project manager at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who oversaw these recent findings of the hottest July, said, if you want to have a planet that looks similar to what we have now, one that's habitable, bet we better change our ways and stop building up CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. Richard Primack, biology professor at Boston University, said, even if it gets just a little warmer and just a little drier in some places, agricultural systems could collapse. Maybe it's that they can't hear it, but, you know, some still don't believe it. What would you say?
Well, there's a mismatch between our human experience and what science can tell us about the future. So in thinking about what it might mean for, you know, a wholesale collapse of ecosystems or agricultural systems or, you know, the loss of all coastal cities on Earth. You know, these are things that could potentially happen in our lifetimes. And these are things that are, in some cases, being locked in right now. And it's really hard to convey as a fact things that feel like science fiction. I struggle with that every day, to not sound like a crazy person talking about this stuff, because it doesn't sound like it's real or could be real, but it is.
How is the insurance industry going to have to change to adapt to global warming?
That's a great question. I think that insurance is a tool that is underestimated because it's boring, you know. But these are people whose job it is to protect us from risk. And that's exactly what climate change is adding risk into a system that is a lot of ways fragile. You know, we saw how quickly the global economy was on the brink just a few years ago in the Great Recession. And it's not a stretch to say that something like climate change could eventually put the global economy at risk again. And we need to start preparing for a risk management system to help those people on the front lines that don't have a nest egg, that are living in vulnerable areas, not necessarily of their own choosing, but maybe because that's where their families always live. That's where their great-grandpa grew up. And they're not just going to uproot their lives because, you know, FEMA says now you're in the 500-year floodplain, and that, you know, by the way, you just had 2 500-year floods in the last 16 months. You know, yeah, within a few decades, we're going to start to see, you know, clear day flooding in places like Miami and New York City, where the water will come above levels we could have seen in previous hurricanes. They're just happening on high tide.
What's the one thing you would want people to start doing right now because of this, the new record in July, this historic rainfall in Louisiana, the drought in California? One thing.
One thing is talk about it. I think the more we can talk about it with our family and friends, just open up a conversation, see where other people are, I think you will be surprised at how many other people you know that are as concerned as you are. It doesn't really help to be sort of stuck in pessimism and despair and to think that we are going to have to sort of work together at some point anyway. It may as well be now. I'm starting to sound like an activist.
You are a meteorologist for Slate, also co-host of the podcast Warm Regards, forced into activism because of what you're seeing. Eric Holthaus, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's talk about it. Your thoughts, especially if you're listening in Baton Rouge or Southern California or in New England, where crops are also dying from drought, are welcome. The number of primetime viewers of the Rio Olympics this year is down 17% compared to the 2012 London Games, and the number of 18 to 49-year-old viewers has dipped even more, 25%. Now, NBC has a whole nerve center devoted to live streaming and social media, but is their investment in the Games worth it if they don't get the primetime tune-in? Kerry Geiger of Bloomberg News is here. Hi, Kerry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Well, and I'm sure NBC executives are not. You know, is the verdict in? Is this ratings drop an indication that people, especially millennials, don't want to be restricted by NBC's primetime, you know, special? That, you know, NBC has been time-shifting events to primetime. Are people, you know, saying, no, I want to stream it live instead?
Well, you definitely have a shift towards the millennial group, definitely watching things more on live. They like the flexibility. They want to watch it when they want to watch it. They don't want to be restricted to a live schedule. That said, live sporting events, including the Olympics, are still a tremendous draw for viewers for the networks. And NBC has invested a significant amount of money for exclusive access to hosting or broadcasting the Olympics through the next several years. And with that, they basically have to shift their revenue profile in terms of how they're making money, whether it's off live TV advertising or through their streaming services. Because if you do watch the Olympics streaming on NBC, you do have to log in a pay credential for your local cable company. So there are ways that they're shifting that. And in terms of making money on the streaming side, you know, you have to remember that companies like Facebook make a tremendous amount of money with mobile advertising. So there are ways for the networks to adapt to this inevitable shift of people starting to watch TV mostly just streaming and not necessarily live.
Right. Well, and you say live, you don't mean live. You mean prime time, because that's the point. They're watching it streamed live. They're not waiting for the nighttime with NBC, where all the big money ad revenue is. And it's so funny, because we were thinking, we used to be all hush-hush all day as reporters, when we would get results from events so people could see the end of an event for themselves at night. And now, we try to be respectful, but they've already seen it. It's out on social media.
Yeah, with Twitter and with Instagram and Snapchat, you can't get away from that. And, you will see the networks adapting to this. And NBC has been very public in saying that they are going to basically shift how they're going to be, basically giving this coverage to the viewer. And the viewers are obviously consuming it very differently.
Right. Although, some people have been angry. Like, I remember the opening ceremonies. You could see tweets about what was happening, but it wasn't happening on your screen because they were shifting it to get the advertising in. NBC's still making a profit, though, right? Big profit.
Yeah, it's still a very profitable event, and I think the challenge for them is right now you're going to have a little bit of growing pains as this transition is happening, because people are just starting to cut the cord now. The next Olympics, you or I, who would basically traditionally watch this on live TV, we may be shifting it to streaming as well. So you're in a little bit of a transition mode here, but all of the major broadcast networks are basically facing the same issue, and the Olympics is a really good kind of test case to see how they handle this. I mean, you have the same thing with the Super Bowl, the Final Four, the NBA championships, big money makers. But, how do you leverage that for streaming?
Yep. Kerry Geiger of Bloomberg News, thank you.
Thank you.
One and a two.
That's the voice of the late, great Levon Helm, founding member of the iconic rock group The Band. He's singing with his daughter Amy on her 2015 debut solo album. The song is called Spend Your Last Dime. Levon Helm died in 2012 of throat cancer, but Amy is carrying the family torch. She still produces The Midnight Rambles, a concert series that her father began, and she's on the road this summer touring behind that 2015 solo album, Didn't It Rain? I talked with Amy Helm last year when that album first came out, and I asked her why she decided to strike out on her own after years of performing with her father and her band Olabel.
It just seemed like the natural next step, after spending so long in Olabel and in my dad's band and really being in the embrace of that and getting stronger as a singer and musician. And I wanted to try something that was more challenging and spread my wings a little bit.
So you're going out on this solo project, but you're also still playing with your band Olabel. What do you get from that you don't get when you're out there on your own?
You have to listen differently when you're attending to a song in that kind of ensemble way. You have to listen differently, and your intention is different. When you come in to sing a harmony, you're coming in to support, and you're coming in to sort of build something collectively. And it's certainly a very different energy I put into it, I think, from a singing perspective.
Well, let's get to some of the music. This one's called Rescue Me.
Been gone for so long, I had to be so strong. Sometimes I find, just don't know which way to go. But the wheels roll all along. Then I see a smile, and I forget for a while. Those days are so near, I won't drown in these tears. If you come.
So I've been listening to this over and over again, and I feel like I'm trying to figure out what your inspiration is there. Am I hearing a little Bonnie Raitt in your voice? Is it a little Alison Krauss? I can't tell. Where do you draw your sound from?
Gosh, I mean, both those singers are huge inspirations to me. I have so many favorites, I wouldn't know where to begin. Certainly Bonnie and Aretha Franklin and Dolly Parton and Otis Redding.
Well, what about your mother, Libby Titus Fagan?
Yeah.
Your father, of course, the great Levon Helm.
Yeah.
When you're from a line like that, do you even have any choice whatsoever? Do you kind of like, you have to go into music?
You know, both my parents were always very cool about not pushing me. I think when they saw that it was what I seemed to do easily and what I was having the most fun doing, then they became very supportive and pushed me when I needed to be pushed, I think.
Can you talk a little bit about your childhood, what it was like growing up in such a musical household?
It's kind of a hard question to answer because it's sort of all that you know. But certainly I was surrounded by a lot of music and grateful for that and definitely given a good musical education from both of my parents.
Tell me about that.
They made sure that I learned the masters, I would say, and I'm sure a lot of us have parents that, you know, made sure that you learned Muddy Waters and Joni Mitchell and all of the great things that you needed to get into your ears.
Well, my parents certainly did not teach me about that.
Well, I bet you could pick out a record or two that they gave you that would stand up with all that, though.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. The Helm name must be an asset for you, but I wonder if putting out a solo album is in a way part of you making your own stand for yourself.
You know, this is something my dad really wanted me to do, and he was a big part of encouraging me towards this. When I was doing the Midnight Rambles with him, he was certainly encouraging me to start working on my own material and to record. Whenever we'd come off the road, I would go into the studio, and he would give me that studio time and help me with money and help me get the recordings going. So it's a step out, certainly, but I feel very much in his embrace with it. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it's hard to make your own name for yourself when you're the daughter of a famous musician, or is that something that you actually want to have with you the whole time?
It's impossible if you have a parent who does the same thing that you do, that you've chosen to do. I think it's impossible to separate yourself from their work and their reputation. But I certainly feel grateful for my dad's his teaching and what he's given to me and for the last name. And I really try to carry it with me and try to use it as something to grow towards.
Well, let's listen to a little more. This is Sing to Me. I mean, that is a beautiful song, and that's that's your father on the drums there.
Yeah, his entrance there is so awesome. I love that.
Tell me about that. What's it like for you to hear your father playing the drums so softly behind you?
Oh, it makes me so happy to hear it. I love that.
So, I mean, what is that like, though, to sort of, from the other side, be hearing your father as a musician supporting you in a song like that? I mean, what's it like?
Well, it's a very moving thing, and it makes me miss him, and it makes me feel proud of him. But I'm just so happy that I got the opportunity to record that with him. It's really special to me.
Say to me, let your drums call out and carry me through the silent trouble.
When I wrote that song, I was definitely, certainly going through a very tough time, and I think I was pining just to be lifted up out of it. But of course, as time goes on, when I sing that song, I've sang it to people I miss, and I've sang it to a lot of different ideas and notions.
You won a Grammy working alongside your father, the 2007 album Dirt Farmer. I want to hear a little bit of that.
I was born on this mountain a long, long time ago, before they knocked down the timber and a strip mined all the coal. When you rose up in the morning before it was daylight, to go down in that dark hole and come back up at night.
Amy, this album was a bit of a comeback for your father. He had had throat cancer, had a major surgery that took his voice from him for a long time, but mm-hmm. he recovered enough to make this album and to go back on tour. And, you know, I see videos of your father, you playing alongside him in that stage in his life where he's had this surgery and he's gotten better and he's singing again. And he looks so incredibly happy. And I just wonder if you sensed that as well, and like what it was like to play with him in those final years of his life.
It was most definitely completely triumphant and joyful. You know, he had come through a very scary walk through his illness, and when he started to get his voice back and making that album, he was also bringing in so many songs that he had learned from his parents and really bringing forward a part of his musical education and his musical experience that he wanted so much to share. And it was just a very, it was a really magical time because, you know, every note and every beat really mattered to him.
What do you think he would say about your new album?
I think he'd be proud. I think he'd be really proud. Yeah.
Let's go out with the title track, Didn't It Rain? Just listen to the rain. So to listen to the rain. All day, all night. All night, all day. Didn't it rain, children? Rain all night long. Didn't it? Oh my Lord, didn't it rain? We spoke with Amy Helm in July last year. She's on tour in the U.S. and Canada through November. We've got more information at hereandnow.org. Walmart announced some surprising news yesterday. After five straight quarters of declining online sales, its e-commerce business jumped nearly 12% last quarter. American consumers spent about $350 billion online last year, and Walmart's rival Amazon led the way. That company has been making record profits, and it plans to launch 40 of its own cargo planes to meet consumer shipping demand. Demand, by the way, that has a side effect. So many of those orders are shipped in cardboard boxes. Bob Gettert is president of the National Recycling Coalition and director of Austin Resource Recovery. They're in Austin, Texas. Bob, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me to this discussion.
Sure. So the reason I wanted to have this discussion is because when I walk into the trash room in my apartment complex, I see a mountain of boxes every day. It seems like it never stops. Are you noticing a lot more cardboard out there?
Absolutely, yes. And with the online shipping and some brick-and-mortar shipping direct to the store, there's a lot more packaging being utilized.
It sounds good for business.
Business is booming compared to 2008, 2009, and so packaging quantities of cardboard, plastics, foam packaging, so forth, has more than doubled in the last 10 years. And regarding old corrugated cardboard recovery, 21,000 tons were distributed in 2015 and with a 93% recovery rate. So pretty good recycling rate of that old cardboard boxes.
Is it more valuable than, say, glass or plastic?
Much more valuable than glass and plastic in that the industry is ready to process this cardboard. If we can gain participation of the consumers to get it into the recycling bin, there are ready markets for this cardboard. And therefore, it's part of American industry to recycle this cardboard.
I wonder what kind of challenges come along with this, though, because if business is booming and these recycling centers maybe like getting the cardboard because it's so valuable, are they having trouble processing at all?
I think there's two problems with processing. In general, the recycling processors very much want these cardboard boxes. But what the processors are really concerned about is non-recyclable material attached to the cardboard. It could be heavy labeling with adhesive. It could be plastic liners or plastic cushion packaging within the cardboard box. And that's what needs to be separated before the cardboard box is recycled.
And should we break it down, fold it down?
Absolutely, yes. And that's the hardest thing to train. We're shipping around in recycling containers a lot of air in air pockets when we don't break down the cardboard boxes. And it's much easier to handle at the recycling facility if it is broken down.
You know, when we toss a piece of cardboard into the trash bin or maybe a glass bottle, there's been a lot of stuff out there that tells us a lot of it's going to China. What can you tell us about that? With this boom in cardboard packaging, is it going overseas as well? Because I understand it's a very big business in China.
There is significant volumes of material going to China as consumer goods are shipped from China to the U.S. Empty containers are utilized for recycled content material, going back to recycling, processing, and made into new products. I would also add that there is a recent trend to revitalize the American economy with domestic recyclers within the U.S.
A lot of people have concerns about recyclables going over to China because think about all the emissions that it takes to get that all the way across the ocean. At what point does it just not make sense to recycle?
I think there is a large carbon footprint for shipping around the world. I think the long-range answer is creating more micro-processing, micro-producing situations rather than major producers in foreign countries. And I think that's a growing trend in the U.S. economy.
It doesn't seem like online shipping is going anywhere but up. And I wonder if we'll get to a point where we simply can't handle the packaging waste that is a result of that. I mean, maybe we can handle it now, but what do you see 10, 15 years down the road?
I see online shippers becoming more and more conscious of their sustainability and their carbon footprint. If you look online for sustainability statements from Amazon or eBay, Walmart, all the major shippers from online, you'll find sustainability statements where they're trying to find better materials. They're trying to reuse packaging. They're trying to reduce the non-recyclables. And I think if that is a continued trend, then the capacity in the recycling market to handle this increased shipping material is there. Part of it is creating a clean product to recycle or package. And the other part is consumer education on what to do with the package to get it recycled.
And of course, the emissions that come from the new planes that are brought online, the trucks on the road. So that's something to consider as well. Bob Gettert is president of the National Recycling Coalition and director of Austin Resource Recovery in Austin, Texas. Bob, thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you very much for this discussion.